that entire training would be based around sort of pattern recognition within gross and histopathology, and maybe a little bit of like ultrastructural pathology. So it's all about learning patterns of lesions with your eyes, and then kind of starting to associate that with whatever your hierarchical knowledge set is. And so then that's what a pathologist does. And then a diagnostic pathologist or a diagnostician, you would try to marry that sort of histopath skill set together with a lot of other ancillary diagnostics. And so you kind of need to be a jack of all trades. You need to be able to do that part of the job, and then also tie that together with some bacteriological assays, some molecular assays, some sequencing, you know, some toxicology. And honestly, probably the biggest thing would be to tie it back to some clinical context.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Hi-D is a pure, effective 25-hydroxy-D3 solution to help pigs improve their vitamin D status. Improve bone health and lifetime productivity with Hi-D. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/hy-d. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. BinSentry, the most trusted feed monitoring solution in the world. Healthier pigs are good for producers, people, profits, and planet. The National Pork Board is committed to improving the health of the U.S. swine herd. Learn more at porkcheckoff.org.
Essential Ag Solutions, bringing innovative science-based solutions to livestock producers.
Hello and welcome back to Swine It. Today we have here Dr. Joe Thomas from Iowa State University to talk with us about applied diagnostics. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to talk with you here about all about applied diagnostics. But before, would like can you please remind our audience here, how did you get where you are today? So kind of quick recap of your professional and academic background.
Yeah, so I grew up on a farrow to finish farm in eastern Iowa. And then I did my undergrad at Iowa State in animal science and agronomy, and then went to vet school at Iowa State as well. I did some graduate work with swine while I was in vet school. That was about the time that PED hit the U.S., so there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. And the Army paid for me to go to vet school, and so I owed them a little bit of service after that. And so I completed that time as an active duty veterinarian doing more mixed animal practice. And then once that obligation was completed, took a job as an associate veterinarian and production manager for AMVC out in Indiana. And then following that, came to Iowa State, did a residency in anatomic pathology through the diagnostic lab, and then took the anatomic path boards and the virology boards shortly after that, and started on as a pathologist here at Iowa State.
Well, so you've been on it since we were born, since we were raised in a farm.
Yeah. Been around pigs for a long time anyway.
And you talked about pathologists, some people refer to as diagnosticians. So what's the difference and what's the definition of what you do today, what keeps you busy?
Yeah, so I guess like a traditional pathologist, you would do like a residency in anatomic pathology, and you may do like a graduate degree in that too. You might do a master's or PhD kind of concurrent with that residency. And that entire training would be based around sort of pattern recognition within gross and histopathology, and maybe a little bit of like ultrastructural pathology. So it's all about learning patterns of lesions with your eyes, and then kind of starting to associate that with whatever your hierarchical knowledge set is. And so then that's what a pathologist does. And then a diagnostic pathologist or a diagnostician, you would try to marry that sort of histopath skill set together with a lot of other ancillary diagnostics. And so you kind of need to be a jack of all trades. You need to be able to do that part of the job, and then also tie that together with some bacteriological assays, some molecular assays, some sequencing, you know, some toxicology. And honestly, probably the biggest thing would be to tie it back to some clinical context. And so the D lab recruits pretty heavily out of practice. They want people who have gone out and done the job to come back and learn to be diagnosticians. And so, yeah, you want to have this knowledge and skills to be able to interpret all those assays and know how to use them. But more importantly, you want to probably be able to like look at your the results that you're putting out as a clinician might look at them.
I see. So pretty much crack the cases and see what's going on. Most of the detective work.
Yeah, and they use so they, the word the phrase diagnostician or the duty position diagnostician then is kind of how they like to describe it, so that you're sort of encompassing all of those things, not just kind of the classical anatomic pathology.
AB Vista, an innovative animal nutrition company offering intelligent solutions for the swine industry. The combination of innovative products, technical expertise, and cutting-edge services provide the ideal tools to drive pig production. To learn more about AB Vista tools, check abvista.com.
And here in the, at Iowa State, you work with multiple species, but this is a swine, so we got to talk about pigs.
Yeah.
And so what you've been seeing in the pig cases, kind of overall, what's the top three or five issues that you're...
Well, and I'd say I think our caseload is probably 75% swine. And for sure, you know, a lot of that is going to bias heavy towards wean to finish. It's just where most of our tissue cases come from. So, mm-hmm. you know, our surveillance assays may be more South Farm and higher up that genetic pyramid, but things that a pathologist is going to get their hands on, it would bias heavy towards the bottom of that production pyramid. And so then I'd say like what we're seeing it's just always very seasonal, right? And so we see a lot of respiratory disease fall into winter, you know, and then you get into January, February, and you start to have your enteric viral pathogens, you know, every January, February, PED, that sort of thing. And then things will start to slow down about this time of year. And then you get into the late summer when farrowing houses are getting hot, and then you start to see some hemolytic E. coli and some coccidia too. And so I'd say it didn't take long in the job to realize like how seasonal all of this is. I think you maybe don't have as much of a perspective on that always from the field, but then when you get to see everybody's cases and kind of the average of all of the pigs in the US, like it's real clear you move from season to season. You know, it seems like we've seen a lot more PED cases for what we typically expect for the late spring this year. And I think field guys would tell you too that they're dealing with a lot more of that here in kind of April, May, into June. So, Yeah. And then, you know, so for the respiratory cases, it's what it always is, right? It's PERS and flu, you know.
PERS and flu.
Yeah. Yep. And I mean, that is by and large the majority of the business that we do. And then, you know, for the enteric cases, it's kind of exactly what you would think, you know, it's PED in February and it's coccidia in August. So.
You mentioned E. coli too, right? In the kind of late summer.
Yep. Yep.
And how about mycoplasma pneumoniae? We hear a lot of positive things on mycoplasma. People try to eliminate mycoplasma, control eliminate from breeding herds. You see that as a reflection in the winter finish as, or not really? What's your perception there from the diagnostician lenses?
Yeah, I mean, probably to answer that question more objectively, you could just pull the diagnostic data and see how many like hard diagnoses of like MHP pneumonia there have been over the last year. I can tell you it's not going to be very many. We detect it pretty regularly if somebody knows they have like a positive flow, but you know, I've had fewer than five good like high pneumonias probably this year.
That's good news, I think.
I mean, to the point where like when I see it, I show it to someone and say, "Oh, look, you know, what's going on?" I'd say a lot more commonly, like when what I do get for those would be like if somebody's homogenizing a GDU. And they're making MHP to fog, and then they want to confirm, and they're sending lungs in from some of those animals. I'll occasionally see like some good acute MHP pneumonias from that, I guess. But in my mind, that's sort of a separate category.
Yeah, because it's like an artificial, right? You're creating it and just confirming, like you said.
Sure. Yep.
How about cases? So you talked about the big ones, the PERS, the flu, the myco, the PD, E. coli. How about cases that are not as frequent, but when they happen, it's a huge impact? What kind of weird cases you're seeing?
Yeah, there's sort of the oddball cases that are interesting, but are of little consequence, probably at the population level. And we try not to chase too many of those wild hares unless somebody really wants to. But in terms of cases that were unusual, but maybe like relevant, you know, could be leveraged to make like a difference for a lot more animals. I'm just trying to think. So right now I'm working up a case for a group where they're seeing maybe 2% in a particular flow of sort of malignant hyperthermia-like lesions. But all the genetic testing we do for the described malignant hyperthermia genes are negative. And so then it gets to be a little more open-ended. Do we want to start to sequence other genes? Is this a different point mutation one of the associated genes that are just sort of commercial assays aren't going to be able to detect? And even that, it's 2% of the pigs in one flow, right? So it's not a huge implication. But it's a interesting case. They're seeing enough of it that they want to work it up. And it's not like the usual diagnostic assays that we do, 100 times a day kind of thing for infectious agents. Thinking about some others, maybe less rewarding one, when there was that issue with gilt and silent estrus a while back. We caught kind of the tail end of some of that, and we're trying to do a more objective analysis of at least the anatomy and see if we couldn't see a difference. And so I worked with the group to get some affected and unaffected animals in, and then we used the software to measure the number and size of the follicles on their ovaries and number of CLs, same kind of thing, diameter of the uterus, just some different kind of data points we had come up with, the amount of like glandular tissue in their uterine mucosa, to see if we couldn't find like a significant difference in one of those metrics, as a starting point before we went into other things. And, ultimately all that was a dead end. And I think, they were able to get away from that clinical problem without us having to actually come up with an answer for what it really was.
Maybe it was infectious, maybe not.
Yeah, probably not. Which makes it a lot harder to, come up with a definitive answer. So,
How about PCV3, PCV4? People sometimes get excited with those new ones.
Yeah. I guess I'd say I tend to be very skeptical, bordering on cynical about newly discovered organisms being pathogens as opposed to like, are you describing something that was here as an endemic agent and, you just didn't have the tools to identify it before. With PCV3, I'd say it pretty clearly causes some reproductive failure. And I don't think there's a lot of argument the other way on that one. You can find it, you can co-localize it to a lesion in fetal tissues in an animal that aborted or had multiple mummies. So I think that's pretty clear cut. And then, but PCV3's ability to cause disease in older pigs, I think, is probably a little more tenuous. You can see some histologic changes with it, but tying those necessarily to a very distinct clinical picture is a little bit harder to do. And so I would be a little bit more skeptical of that. And PCV4, I mean, I don't even ever test for it, so I really don't probably have anything intelligent to say about it. I would just remain skeptical until, I just saw lesions to convince me otherwise.
And some of those questions, can they cause disease? Yeah, sure they can, but then how often do they cause? That's a completely different question, right? Understand. And how about back to PRRS virus? Because there are some that we talked today and they say, hey, I think this is the worst PRRS we've seen, but we've heard that before too. And so based on what you see, you said PRRS is still very common. Would you say that the lesions are more severe than in the past or more of the same? Or
like you could have an acute fulminant PRRS infection in an animal with probably any PRRS virus. And that lesion, at least within the lung, is probably pretty much going to look the same, where you've got alveoli are full of dead necrotic macrophages and you have an interstitial pneumonia, everything to go with it. It seems like with some of what you see clinically is like a more severe PERS, I guess, that people started to see around maybe 2020. Like I would associate that. And, you know, so maybe they're seeing like more abortion, very high wean to finish mortality. Maybe they're having like acute dead sows with it, you know, if they have like a lateral break. I guess I would associate that with where I start to see lesions outside of the lung. So you can see a bit of a PERS encephalitis sometimes. You can see, you know, kind of massive lymphoid necrosis or lymphocytolysis in lymphoid tissues when it gets really severe. And honestly, you can even start to see that lymphocytolysis in some mucosal tissues too. So you'll see it in the lamina propria, the intestine, and other places. And so I think when people think they're seeing like a really, really severe PERS that's worse than what they're used to, I think a lot of times it's the lesions outside of the lung that are probably correlating with like what they're seeing clinically. And all those things had been described before, you know, this most recent, you know, supposedly more virulent PERS arose. So I'm not sure that it's anything new. It just seems like we reach some level of stability and then you get a new variant. And then, you know, there's some instability in the relationship between pathogen and host. And it just takes a few years to get back to that. I think the worst of those lesions I saw was like 2021, probably kind of, you know, coincides with when the L1C popped up. And so I think I see less and less of those lesions now.
That's glad to hear. That's good to hear. Perceptions on strep suis, GPS, that type of bacterial challenges.
I'm definitely not like the expert on those agents. I suppose the way that I have seen them handled by production systems that makes the most sense to me would be sort of trying to stabilize them within a given flow. And so I suppose if strep suis, GPS, and say like MHR are responsible for 2 or 3% of your wean to finish mortality, just as like endemic agents, and you want to try to stabilize that relationship a little bit more and get that down to 1 to 2%. Well, it seems like if you think about where those are coming from, they're almost certainly going down maternal lines, right? And so if you it's not like there's really going to be any significant amount of those coming in with the semen. And so it's like, well, whatever I have for my set of endemic agents, I sort of buy when I buy my gilt, right? And you could probably take that up one level too. And so if I have multiplier A and it's supplying sow farms 1 through 5, and then I look at all the downstream wean to finish barns from that, like if I wanted to try to implement a strategy to control an endemic agent, like those three bugs, I'd probably want to characterize those three bugs up at the multiplier level. And then, you know, if I were going to try to, whatever I was going to do to stabilize that, you know, relationship, if it was, I think I should stabilize this by vaccinating my commercial sows, you know, pre-farrow or something. Well, then maybe, you know, you come up with a common vaccine to that multiplier that you use on all those downstream sow farms. Yeah, I think what that's the control strategy that I've seen that at least in my mind, from like an ecological standpoint, makes the most sense to me to how you should probably try to approach dealing with like endemic secondary agents. Is, you know, characterize the agents, think about it as going down maternal lines, and then probably try to implement like a common stabilization protocol that, you know, sort of with that whole flow in mind.
That's a good to remind people that they are not all the same, right? They may be all strep, but they're different, or GPS or whatever it is. I hear you saying, yeah, let's characterize them, genotype, serotype, whatever it is that's for that particular one, and be strategic about immunizing the flow and understanding what you have.
Yeah.
Your job as a diagnostician, as I understand, part of it is serve the industry, trying to crack the code, understand what's going on. But then people have to help you to help them, right? If you look back at out of every 100 cases, how many arrived with everything you like to see in terms of sample quality, sample size, background information of the clinical history, so on and so forth?
It sort of depends on who the actual submitter is, right? And so I think probably the bigger picture view of this would be, It seems like the types of submissions we get as a laboratory are kind of dictated, or they seem to follow certain patterns that align with whatever the business model is of the unit that is submitting. And so if it is a production system, you know, like a large scale production system, and they have a staff veterinarian, those submissions kind of look the same or relatively the same across different types of, you know, or different companies. As long as their like business model is similar, those the questions they're trying to answer and how they approach diagnostics seems to be similar. And I'd say that category is different than like the types of submissions I get where the veterinarian is in like an owner or management relationship with those pigs, right? So if that's like a Carthage, AMVC, Pipestone, whoever, I would say like those kinds of submissions almost are like a different category. The way they approach questions, how they want to answer, how they utilize resources, they kind of tend to look similar, but they look different than what I get from veterinarians working for production systems. And then I'd say, you know, probably the third category would be like if your relationship is like as a consulting veterinarian, you know, you're billing hours and that's your, if that's the business model, I'd say that's sort of the third category of like the kinds of submissions that we see. And if I were to throw them all in buckets, like it would seem like pretty much what the submission forms look like, what the submissions look like, the types of questions they want to answer line up pretty well with whatever the business model is for those particular groups. I think that's all fine. I think, you know, what motivates them, what's the profit motive, what are the questions they want to answer are different. And so their submissions are going to look different. And, you know, I think whenever you're trying to leverage a veterinarian or you leverage support staff to make a veterinarian's time go further, right? It's you add them to their level of like training requirement, just practical training for field men or whoever to do these submissions. And so, yeah, from time to time, submission forms are incomplete or whatever, but you know, it's no big deal. We generally, if you've been in that world, you understand. And then, you know, we could generally think through what it is that you're probably trying to figure out. And if I can always pick up the phone and call, right? So by and large, I think our submitters do a pretty good job, you know.
Any putting all together, any type of non-negotiables that you'd like to see, hey, if you want the diagnostician to help you with your case, don't forget number one, two, or three? Or does it really vary drastically?
I think if you were going to put one thing in there, there's a box where you can answer or tell me what your diagnostic question is.
Okay.
And to me, that is the most succinct, useful thing to help us understand where you're coming from. You know, it may be that you know that South Farm broke with PERS and everything weaning out of there is going to have a PERS pneumonia and you really don't care about that. You want to characterize the secondary pathogens, or you know all that, but now you're seeing some looseness and you want to know about the diarrhea. But that, you know, you can't read minds. And so I might be spending all my time working up this other set of lesions and that's old hat for you. And you really were curious about this other thing. And so that diagnostic question is a great place for you to just, you know, in a few words, say exactly what you're trying to get out of the submission. And then that helps us point things in the right direction. And to the same, you know, tune, then if I get done with everything I'm doing and very clearly my report doesn't answer your question, like I wasn't able to with what I did for diagnostics, then I can at least address that and be like, hey, I know this is what you wanted to know, but like I'm not seeing this, or this, or I didn't have the right sample type for that, or you know, this assay was negative, whatever. And I think it's just a real nice, succinct spot in the report for the submitter and the pathologist to communicate.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. So you're not asking for, hey, spend 10 minutes writing all the history of the farm. It's just simple as, this is my diagnostic question. Can you help me figure out if this is going on or not, right? So keep it simple, but communicate that so you guys know what you're looking for.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So
in animal nutrition, precision matters. Choline chloride is an essential ingredient that supports growth, muscle development, and liver health in poultry, swine, aquatic animals, and pets. Backed by decades of expertise and certified quality, Eastman's liquid choline chloride provides a cost-effective solution and delivers consistent performance across species. Eastman helps you get more from your nutrition program. Learn more at eastman.com.
Okay, yeah, and you kind of mentioned this before, but so besides just diagnostics, what are the other ways in which you mentioned kind of research, but what else can you guys help the industry, help serve the health professionals and ultimately help the pigs in the position you are today?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, so we're a service lab, 100%, right? And we receive funding from the state of Iowa, in addition to like the fees for the service that we do. And so the service is, you know, first and foremost, probably our biggest mission. But then, yes, we do research quite a bit out of the VDL, and it should be mostly fairly applied, right? Not too far removed from industry, trying to answer, you know, applied questions. And so most of the funding sources that we'd go for as a lab would be coming from either USDA or like a commodity group, something like that. And so, you know, that's definitely a value added. And then I would say that like so much of the data that we generate from our diagnostic cases can help inform some of that research too, or can even be the data set, you know, for that research question. And then I guess jumping back over to the service side. So, you know, so much of the model, I guess, you know, since the inception of the lab has been, here's this case, here's the data generated from this case, you know, here's the fee for this test, here's the fee for this, you know, interpretation, whatever. And, you know, it's a kind of a very modular model of how you would go about like charging for a client. And say Roger is pretty forward thinking, our lab director. And as time has gone on, we've created bigger and bigger databases trying to capture all the data that we gather, right? So whether that's morphologic diagnoses tied to like an ancillary data result, you know, the actual just assay results themselves, that kind of thing. We do a better job storing and organizing that data now as a laboratory. And so, you know, as a maybe a value added service, we've started to offer to some of our maybe larger, more integrated clients some kind of enterprise level diagnostics where we can, for a fee, provide a pathologist and then more of somebody with a background in data science to go in and look at whatever question it is that you want to answer, right? So say, you know, for example, if I have this flow of pigs and I want to somehow summarize all the diagnostic results for that particular flow to try to see how much PCV instability I have in flow A versus flow B. Like now, we can kind of go back and answer those bigger picture questions for some of our larger, more integrated clients. And so we have seen quite a few try to take advantage of some of that. And I don't know, it's sort of, we're here to help answer questions. And it's fun when we get to kind of work together to answer bigger picture questions that probably have like, you know, a bigger impact on a bottom line and that could be leveraged to make bigger decisions.
Makes sense. That goes beyond just one case, one set of tissues, right? Goes more strategic questions that will requires a bigger plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And we still get to use the results that we generate in individual cases. It's just, we get to see them in the aggregate, organized in a way that makes sense for that client as opposed to just as one-offs. So.
I'll remind here our audience a little quick. My name is Daniel Linhares. I'm interviewing here Dr. Joe Thomas, and this is the Swine It. If you like it, take a time to share it, love it, repost it, whatever your platform allows. Joe, getting to the end here, anything else technical here related to what we've been talking about that we kind of left behind?
I think we as a lab, and I'll say this, speak for the whole lab, but I would say that generally we would pride ourselves on serving our clients. And you know, we obviously believe in the mission of agriculture and, you know, we want to provide a good service to our state and to the country. And so, you know, we strive to do that. And, you know, if there's ever anything we can do a better job as diagnosticians, for sure, you know, we're always open to that advice. And yeah, it was just great to be able to talk to you today.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Vaccinova, formulate to your needs. Custom-made vaccines. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost pig health and performance. Nexus, powered by SAM, where science meets performance. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Uniferon 200 from Pharmacosmos, the iron dextrin for baby pigs, which promotes faster growth. Better production performance starts with Eastman Choline Chloride. Visit eastman.com. In swine production, performance is everything. At Lucta, we know your success depends on measurable results. That's why our feed additives go beyond improving palatability. They're scientifically designed to enhance feed intake, support animal well-being, and drive optimal growth. From the wean transition to periods of stress, our solutions deliver what matters most: resilient animals, improved performance, and a stronger bottom line. Backed by decades of expertise and a commitment to innovation, Lucta is redefining swine nutrition. Because when your herd thrives, so does your business. Lucta, create, connect, inspire. Visit lucta.com to learn more.
So we're going to go to the final questions here that we like to ask for everyone we interview, and those are the big three. And so the first one is, or the famous three, and the first one is, in your opinion, your perspective, what is that differentiate successful professionals?
Yeah, I guess there's a few people that I have known that I would look up to that I would say, like, I've always been impressed with what they were able to build as a company or how they were able to lead large groups of people. And probably the common themes that I've seen among them have been sort of the ability to look out strategically. You know, they can see trends, or at least, like, when things happen, they're looking for what the opportunity is, as opposed to, like, always how to put out the fire, right? And so they think strategically and they look out long term, and they tend to always be looking at an, you know, what other people see as a crisis, they see as an opportunity.
On the big prize, on the long term.
Yeah, and then honestly, those same people have always been, like, some of the most positive people, you know, I've ever been around. It's easy to get cynical or to, you know, think poorly of people or of situations or of things, but the people I've seen that have been very successful, like, man, they're always excited about something, and they're always seeing kind of like the, and I said they see the opportunity, but, like, they're always seeing the thing that they agree with that situation, you know? And so I think that positivity kind of, and that, like, opportunity outlook seems to be a pretty common thing for the people that I've seen, where they seem to have been pretty successful in whatever it is they chose to do, whether it was in military, in, you know, private practice, or even within academia. So
nice one. And so the second question is, what's your favorite pig related resource, if you have one?
Yeah, my guess is everybody says disease is a swine, right? I don't know, but
a lot of people, we hear that a lot. Yeah.
And I mean, that's the best book, right? That, at least that I've ever read on it. And it's very comprehensive. But so, since everybody else says it, there's a porcine dermatology book that gets put out by the OIE that whenever I get a weird pig derm case, I go looking through that book. And so it's definitely not the best all-encompassing pig book, but it's good to know that it exists. It's like the OIE Atlas of Porcine Dermatology. But yeah, I've had a few weird diagnoses where I'm trying to work up skin lesions for people, that book has been pretty handy. And I think it's pretty obscure, so it's a good one to know that's out there.
The book itself, does it contain like an atlas of pictures?
Yeah, so it's
Oh, you have it by your side.
I have it right there. Yep, it's right there. It's an atlas as a book, but there is quite a bit of, you know, text and just summary information in it too. Turns out there's a lot more to it than I thought. So yeah.
All right. Thanks for sharing that one. And how about non pig related book or movie or anything that has kept your interest here recently?
Non-pig related books. So I'm trying to read, there's a synopsis of, like, the Summa Theologica from St. Thomas Aquinas. That's the, people call it, like, the Summa of the Summa, but it's just a condensed version of some of his theology. And I don't know if it's my favorite. It's what I'm currently trying to read. It's pretty dense stuff. So yeah.
I'm sure it keeps you busy.
Yeah. So.
Well, thanks for sharing that one as well. And that's all about we have for today. Thank you for taking the time for being with us today, and see you all next time.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.